welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
Our guest today is Bernard Murphy. Good morning, Bernard.
Hey, Dan and Mike, and thanks for inviting me.
Just in a quick example of how intertwined the semiconductor industry is, here's our backstory. I worked for Mike at Zycad in the 1990s, and we stayed friends after that. And when I started SemiWiki in 2011, Mike was at Atrenta, and Mike was one of our first clients. Mike then introduced me to Bernard, who was CTO of Atrenta. And after Synopsys bought Atrenta in 2015, Bernard came to blog on SemiWiki, and Mike had left and went to back to eSilicon, and he signed up SemiWiki yet again. eSilicon was sold in 2020, and Mike came to blog on SemiWiki after that. So the circle of semiconductor life, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the truth is there's about a dozen people in EDA and semiconductor. They just keep changing jobs, so there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, first, let's start with how Bernard came to semiconductors from a PhD in nuclear physics from Oxford. That should be an interesting story, Bernard.
Well, it's a fairly familiar story for almost anybody. I was following a girlfriend. So she returned to New York to go to med school at Columbia. I just finished my graduate degree. I was looking around for potential things I could do in the US, and I ultimately found a job in semiconductors in Florida. And that, of course, didn't work out so well with the relationship, but coming from the UK, I loved the location, you know, sunny Florida versus cold and wet England, and I really liked the job. So that got me started. I went into EDA R&D in, it was Harris Semiconductor, which I think you remember, Mike.
Ah, yes, indeed, Bernard. Harris certainly is part of that circle of life.
And there I developed a logic simulator. And over the years, I got into static timing analysis, cell characterization, mask data prep. I touched a lot of bases in EDA and had a lot of fun, but eventually decided that maybe I wanted to try something different. So I moved into strategic partner management in Cadence around the verification products. And so did that for a while. I did a stint in startup sales. So I've done a little bit of marketing, a little bit of sales, quite a bit of R&D. And then eventually I returned to R&D to create and launch Spyglass at Atrenta, so static verification. And pretty much stayed in that for, I think at Atrenta, we were doing that for about 15 years before Atrenta was acquired by Synopsys. So a lot of background in R&D, particularly in verification, and with glancing runs into marketing and sales, and a little bit of applications engineering.
And now you're an expert blogger.
Well, I don't know about that, but certainly since Spyglass was acquired by Synopsys, I switched, as you said, into blogging for SemiWiki, which has been an absolute blast. I can't imagine having done something more fun. I mean, it's the classic example of when work is something you enjoy doing, it's not work. And even though I'm retired, I'm still having fun doing it.
Exactly my story as well. Let's talk about some of the your verification journey. Let's talk about some of the verification drivers and trends that you've experienced.
Sure. So I'm going to make a statement which is going to insult all three of us, but I think it's a meaningful position, which is that I consider everything before 2000 kind of the prehistory, the archaeology of verification. And the modern verification era, kind of our Cambrian explosion, started around 2000. So In 2000, Richard Goering, who many of us know, published a piece on his surprise when he went to the Embedded System Conference that there were so many IP vendors had turned up there. And, you know, Embedded Systems Conference was supposedly a software conference and a processor conference, but why are all these IP vendors around? No big surprise now, but then it was just starting to become apparent that a lot more IP was software driven, of course, but a lot of other things too, which meant that in building chips, software had started to become more significant. So that's kind of point one. Point two was that around the same time and for very similar reasons, platform-based design was taking off. So you have this, in principle, like a Lego-like approach to building highly complex systems, and you just snap these pieces together with pre-proven IPs and do that in different ways, and you very quickly build variants of the core architecture. And that was a very appealing idea to a lot of companies. I know Texas Instruments, for example, was very big in that, and NXP and many other companies, probably Philips in those days. So you could build a lot of stuff, very configurable, much faster, lower unit cost, lower power, high performance, lots of goodness merits to it. But the problem you have, of course, is that you now have many, many more components on the SoC and software running on top of that. And verification in such a system scales quadratically with the number of components and exponentially with software size. So verification complexity on these systems goes through the roof. So that's kind of my starting point. And that started to then create this Cambrian explosion of new methodologies and new capabilities. So you see emulation becomes very important because you have to just run bigger systems, and then you have to run software against those systems. Formal becomes very important, formal verification, because you ask the obvious question, isn't there some way I can prove this stuff works correctly other than just brute force testing? And formal has its limitations, but it's still a very interesting technology for certain classes of problem. You start to see more standardization of test methodologies that, you know, you had Vera and E and various things like this that eventually kind of converged on UVM around 2010. And so those were intended to give you kind of layered approaches to accelerating and expanding test development. And then more recently, you started to see more investment in software-driven verification and PSS, the kind of, you like, system-level UVM way to randomize testing. And of course, FPGA prototyping. So that's more of an emphasis on being able to debug software on a hardware prototype, but without a lot of debuggability in the hardware. So a couple more points here. One is that now you're doing all this testing, you're accelerating it and so on, that's great. But then an even more pressing question becomes, when are we done? Is, you know, what, when can we say that we've done enough testing? So that became a lot more challenging because the earlier stages of testing were more based on, you have a lot of smart people or a bunch of smart people who can imagine all the test scenarios and they can kind of fit them all inside their heads. But now when you have these huge systems, that's very difficult to do. So of course there was emphasis on different types of coverage, you know, statement coverage and functional coverage. You start to see assertion-based verification to test for key behaviors. You see constrained random to cover a little outside the edges of what you can imagine. And you start to see the beginnings of some kind of bigger in-circuit kind of testing. So in-circuit emulation, where you have your model of a system on an emulator running inside a larger system. Or you're looking at virtual prototyping to prove out more of a software with a very simplified model of the hardware and kind of bridging between these. And then to add to all that mess, you've got additional complications. So you have much more emphasis on mobile applications, cell phones, of course, but also wearables and various other kinds of devices, which means you have to have much more aggressive power management. And that adds a layer, it really is a layer, to the verification complexity, because you've got all the functionality that has to work correctly. Then it also has to work correctly against power domains turning on and off, and voltage domains switching, and clock domains changing frequency. So that's really tough. And it's because it adds a layer of complexity, you have to use some level of static and formal to give you certainty that you're at least covering some of the angles correctly. But you still got a need for dynamic verification because you can't do it all through static and formal. Another layer is automotive. So that pushes safety management. So you've got to do all of this safety management, detection and mitigation, which takes you, there's a back to the future aspect in this, because you have to do fault simulation on this stuff to detect whether your mitigation techniques are going to cover for potential faults when you have a neutron come in and ionize the silicon. Can you mitigate that fault? And then on top of that, that continues to evolve too, because now there's a big emphasis on fail operational behavior. So that, some people call this limp home. You say, as I'm driving along at 60 miles an hour on the freeway and something goes bad, of course, you don't want to immediately crash into the vehicles around you. You want to be able to pull over to the side of the freeway where then you can go call a service truck or something. But to do that, the electronics has to fail in a predictable way and a manageable way. So now you start to see things like safety islands and so on, and all of that has to be verified. And then, of course, there's security. So security is a huge deal, and it will be never ending. Whatever we put into a design, people will find ways to hack around it. We're getting a little bit more systematic about it now with hardware roots of trust, but they're still very complex to verify. And the kind of the infrastructure and the methodologies behind security verification are still fairly immature. So there's quite a lot of ad hoc approaches to this stuff. There's some neat stuff being done with specialized assertions, which can be checked in emulation, but it's still kind of early days for security verification. It's a huge problem. It's a growing problem. There's lots of great stuff being done. Still a lot of stuff to be done.
Bernard, in listening to this discussion, there's one thing that pops into my head. You talk about some standards, which I think helps the answer to this question, but when is verification done? I mean, one piece of conventional wisdom is when you run out of time is when verification is done. But is it crisper than that now with all these standards that you must test to? Do you know when you're done, or do you just keep testing until you run out of time?
Well, there's to some extent, yes. You test, it's an ROI calculation. You are going to do the very best possible job you can to test within an investment envelope, and then you stop. So what we're trying to do, and what we'll continue to try to do, is to refine the quality of that testing. It's long, long time since we've been able to even conceivably imagine doing complete testing. It's the size of the space that you're trying to test in is kind of gigantic. So the issue is not so much are you going to cover everything as are you going to cover everything important to cover. And I'd say that things like ISO 26262 some of the MITRE has a thing in security, following the standards like UPF for power management, doing some of the in-circuit emulation types of testing that test your design against a larger board. All of these are tests of, is my, you could almost imagine calling it validation rather than verification. Is my design fit for use as opposed to completely tested?
You know, Bernard, I track design cycles and design costs pretty closely through each node. And, you know, the one thing that stands out is the cost of verification just seems to keep increasing each node. You know, some of the other categories will stay constant or decrease, but verification seems to be a growing problem.
I guess the implied question is, could it ever get smaller or at least stay the same and not grow? I think that at some level, you know, what can you say does not need to be verified or does not need to be verified as much? Whenever you're talking about soft IP or even hard IP integrated in a design, you almost can't say that you don't need to re-verify it. I mean, you don't need to, if you're going to integrate an ARM core and you're not going to mess with it into your design, then you don't need to repeat every possible aspect of verification that ARM themselves did, but you do need to do some level of verification around that. If you're integrating a much more advanced or modern, no, those aren't the right words, something that's dealing with a newer technology, you know, a piece of AI or something like that, you probably need to do a lot more detailed verification around that. But there are still, even in those cases, there are levels of testing you need to do in the integration. I mean, the famous example I can think of, or I don't know about famous, but it's an example I can think of is you use one of these security cores, a hardware root of trust in your design, you integrate it into the design and everything should be good, right? Your design is now secure. Well, that's not the case because the way you integrate it into your design could just create new security holes. So you continue to have to test that kind of thing, even though these are very well proven IP. So back to your question, is there a way you could potentially move up to not having to do as much testing? I think there you do have to go to something like chiplets. I mean, back in the day when we were just building chips and not systems on chip, you didn't have to go in and re-verify everything about the chip as a user of that chip. I could see that working with chiplets potentially, but not as much at a lower level. It continues to grow pretty much exponentially unless you start dividing down to narrower use cases. And that'd be kind of my next point.
You know, if I could just pile on here for a second about the complexity and the problem of testability, something happened recently at a client that a light bulb went off in my head, and it's the following. In terms of design, you can come up with extremely brilliant new architectures and new strategies for achieving a particular design goal, reuse, whatever, and you can get it done fast, really fast. Mm-hmm. But the problem is verifying it still takes a long time no matter what. So it's kind of, verification is doomed to be the long pole no matter what.
Yeah, and I think that this isn't just true for electronic design. I mean, I think it's just as true for mechanical design. I mean, the infamous, the Boeing Max thing, you still have lots of systems that can go wrong. You just haven't detected them yet.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I noticed recently on the SemiWiki job board is the openings for verification people is just growing you know, exponentially, and it has been ever since we started the board last year. So, I don't see that. I don't see that changing because of the added complexities we're adding on the chips. And, you know, it's nice that we have faster machines and we're doing verification in the cloud. But I think verification will be an interesting topic, you know, for years to come, for sure.
It's good for the verification engineers because there's a lot of job security in the job.
Yeah. It's good for the EDA guys because the amount of software is going to continue to grow. So, Bernard, given all that, what do you see for the future for verification? What are the challenges? You know, what type of things are we going to experience coming around the next node or two?
So, good question. I've put some thought into this. And of course, you know, there's always going to be plenty of opportunity to further refine the core of what we're doing. So Paul Cunningham, Jim Hogan, and I show that in our innovation and verification series that, you know, there's a lot of sharpening the saw, as the sales guys like to put it, of continuing to refine existing approaches. But what really, what I think about a lot is, what is the next Cambrian trigger? You know, the next thing that's going to cause an explosion in new techniques. And sharpening the saw that won't do that. It will continue to improve what we've got, but it won't create brand new horizons. I think the next Cambrian trigger is going to be around use cases. So if you think about, you know, earlier I talked about software and lots more components and so on, that created an explosion in size. What really we've been talking about earlier is how do you rein in the use cases? Because if you try to test something kind of in the abstract and you say, let's prove it works under all possible cases, which of course isn't possible, but even what we imagine might be all possible cases or all useful cases, you still don't really know. And the only way you can know is to start testing within the system or within the system of systems that this device is going to be used. That isn't an abstract concept anymore. You know, if you look at Siemens, who are fairly advanced in this, they now have a car, not a model car, but a real car, linked with a simulation model for testing out autonomy or ADAS. And why do they need to do this? Well, what they're doing in this system is they're not just modeling a chip or a chip plus software or a chip plus software plus a few sensors. They're essentially modeling the whole car. So they've got mechanical modeling in this. They've got, you know, RF modeling. They've got all kinds of modeling. One of the things that they model is the braking system. I'm talking about the rubber tires rotating on the road and the brakes being applied to those tires and how the car brakes and how the body responds and all that kind of thing. Why is that relevant? Well, you know, when we see kind of in our world an AI system detecting a pedestrian or a car or whatever obstacle ahead, you know, we're amazed that it can detect that thing. And then we say, well, okay, you apply the brakes and you slow down and stop and you don't hit it. But what if it's been raining and it's been raining maybe after a long dry spell? So we all know what's going to happen. You're going to skid because the car is not going to stop as fast under those circumstances as it would if the road was dry. But you can't model that without modeling the mechanics of the tires turning on a road with a different friction profile. And maybe if you're turning a corner, you know, the body is going to swing out. And so that's going to have momentum that you're going to have to correct for, or at least the actuators and the AI are going to have to correct for. So you need to model the whole system. And the reason that Siemens have built a digital twin and they have an actual car to mirror that is to is to model this stuff and correct and learn from these systems how the whole system has got to behave. That is what I mean by looking at use cases. You can't really figure out a use case like this you're going to ripple down to how the chip behaves without modeling the whole system. And you could say, well, that's just automotive, you know, that's a special case, but it really isn't. The same thing is happening in data centers. So you have, you know, the big hyperscalers, the cloud providers are doing all kinds of fancy things to optimize data caching in the data centers. So you've got warm storage and networking and so on. You have the same thing happening in 5G infrastructure. You have the same thing happening in robotics for warehouse automation. So the point is, the system is no longer just a chip and some software running on the chip. It's this whole big thing with many things going on. And you're only going to figure out real use cases by looking at the whole thing. Now, what does that turn into in terms of solutions? I don't know, but I think that's the next Cambrian trigger.
Excellent. I think this is a good place to stop. Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Bernard, for the excellent content. We will definitely be covering this topic in more detail on later podcasts. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.